Okay, now on the Collins rig, I mean, I'll give you just an out, they had two versions of it. Collins in their wisdom built the 30S1 and the KWS1. Now they had two different versions. The version, the last version of it, of the 30S1, has in it, in the filament transformer. Now I think that filament transformer is still available through Peter Dahl. And basically, here's what it, how it works. When you put the power on, there's a relay that stays open and puts a 20 watt resistor in the filament supply in series with the primary of the transformer. The other end of the transformer goes to a filament, they call it a filament adjust resistor. Let me recall what the value was. 25 ohms, 25 watts. I remember it now. 25 ohms, 25 watt resistor. That's in series with one end of the transformer. The other end of the transformer, I just said, went to a 25 ohm, 20 watt wire wound resistor. And that's with a relay across it so that the inrush, reduced the inrush current on the filament. So that once that relay closed, what the heck did they call this? Particular relay that they used there. It's like in a tube. It looked like a sealed vacuum type of device. You know, it's one of those time delay seals. So once that relay is closed, then the transformer then goes directly to the line. But I could say the other end of the line has got that resistor in series with it. That's that 25 ohm, 20 watt resistor, Dick, for adjusting the filament. Now the transformer they use is Peter Dahl transformer. It's rated at 5 volts at, I believe, 20 amps. Over.
Yeah, and here we go. 5 amps and 20 amps at 5 volts. You try to build a switching regulator that runs efficiently there. I don't care if it's a switching regulator, linear regulator, or whatever. Very tough design. Here's what I'd much rather see you do, Rich. The rheostat is an approach. And you're a kind of a guy that's careful enough. You're going to be monitoring that voltage on the summer days when you've got low voltage because everybody's running their air conditioner. And you're going to readjust your rheostat accordingly. That's one approach. But you could have your cake and eat it too. You could build a switching regulator on the primary of the transformer that is run by a silicon-controlled regulator, silicon-controlled rectifier, or a silicon-controlled switch. A silicon-controlled switch is one of these things that you can turn on and turn off, and you can turn it on and turn it off with a good electronic circuit that you could design that skips cycles. You can make the RMS voltage on the filament anything you want by skipping complete cycles, and you'll be doing it at 100% efficiency. In other words, if you wanted a 5% decrease in the voltage, that means one cycle out of every 20, you would drop entirely. Your circuit would be looking at the Con Ed power, and it says, hey, Con Ed's about to go through zero switching. I'm going to open up my silicon control switch on the primary of the transformer, and I'm going to put no voltage into that filament during this 60 cycle, one sine wave. And then for the next 19 cycles, I'll turn it back on. The system works at 100% efficiency, and you can get both the slow start that Mel is talking about. That resistor, that 25 ohm or whatever it is resistor, 20 watt resistor they throw in there, gives the filament a gentle start. Very nice way to go. They gently turn on the filament every time you turn the rig on. It'll give you a lot more life in the tube. Then you slowly bring the filament up to the right operating temperature, and after it's been running for the right number of minutes, you then hit the transmitter. And then, both by skipping cycles, you can do the soft start, and by skipping cycles, you can get the exact voltage you want on the filament in an RMS manner. Now, calculating the RMS for the skip cycle is a little bit more complicated, but I guarantee there's a way of doing it. So that's a possible approach, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet. Eric, by way of your very expensive transmitters, I wonder if they've done something similar. I think most of the time you guys run servo-controlled variacs on all three phases. Back to you, Eric.
All right, well, two things I wanted to say. One, actually, is, well, in the analog VHF that transmitted was used a step start circuit to control the inverts. But generally it is variac on the input to the filament supply. But the thing that I was interested in stating to you guys is that talking about the chemistry of the cathode, as the tubes age, like one tube generates 60 kilowatts worth of output. There you've seen the transmitter ding. As the tubes age, the foliated material on the cathode begins to change a little bit. And what happens is now we run a filament voltage of exactly 6.3 volts. It's very tight. It's actually just maintain that, but by input regulation, is really a motorized variac on the input side that guarantees no matter what the line voltage is, the filament voltage will be exactly 6.3 volts. But as the tube gets on in age, what happens is the material will then start to expel itself off the cathode surface. And what you get is little pieces of foliated material in the vacuum, causes an arc over, and you get chloride. So the difference between, say, 6.3 volts is the tube hits maybe 20,000 hours, and 6.25 volts or 6.2 volts is enough to stop that business from happening. And as the tube gets older and older, you might actually want to lower the voltage as opposed to the thinking of raising the voltage. In the analog VHF world, that's a little bit of a different story. There you're talking about tetrodes and possibly even triodes. Whereas as the tube begins to get older, the filament actually doesn't produce as much heat. The material that they make the cathode and the amount of cathode current is way different than, say, in the IoT. You kind of do the opposite. You go from 6.3 to 6.4 to 6.5 volts as the tubes get older. So it's just a different way of thinking, but the chemistry of the cathode plays a very important role. Dick? Oh, I got one other question for you. What's the longest trombone you've ever used?
I guess the longest trombone I've ever used was in the vicinity of 18 inches long, is a U-shaped object, so it had nearly 36 inches of total length. That was made by the General Radio Company, and I think I have two of those. But here's my question to you. Both when it comes to the voltage of an incandescent light bulb, where you get fantastically longer light if you lower the voltage a little bit, or if you go and buy a long light bulb, what's really going on is you're feeding it 120 volts, but it's designed for 130 volts. That's where the long life is coming from. It runs a little lower in efficiency, but it lasts a lot longer. When you put together both the life and the rate at which the thorium products bubble up through the cathode and whatever, you put that all together, where Rich has got these beautiful 8877 tubes, he would like to get out of them moderate performance, not absolute tip-top power output. He knows darn well that if he puts out 1,350 watts versus 1,425 watts, nobody's going to know the difference. But if that little bit of difference requires more filament voltage and it's going to half the life of his cathode, that's a lousy trade-off. So when you put the whole picture together, would you recommend that he adjust the filament voltage to be on the low side of center as opposed to the high side of center of the recommended voltage from IMAC? Back to you, Eric.
You be to HWW with a solution and a comment?
Just taking house. Well, from the commercial operator's point of view, we tend to want to do two things. First of all, we never turn the transmitter off, but yet we put a lot of emphasis on step starting the tube. So we don't want to whack the filament all of a sudden, make it really hot, because that does bad things. We like to bring it up slowly. Generally, before we'll put any kind of B-plus on the tube, maybe about 2 or 3 minutes, depending upon the particular tube. But as a general rule, you want to go on the low side, but you also want to watch the bias on the grid. There's an interaction between the two, and there's an optimum point where you don't want to be drawing too much cathode current. You want it to be just right. So, and every tube's different. Every tube's not exactly the same. That's why they give you knobs. Go ahead, Dick.
Interesting. Howie, go ahead.
Yeah, why, if he could use a separate transformer for the 5 volts, why don't he run a UPS? And the UPS will give him a sine wave, and the UPS will regulate. It won't matter what's happening to the 120-volt line. He can take the 120 volts, go to a UPS system, and then go into a transformer. And the UPS can give him a precisely whatever voltage, and the UPS won't care if the input voltage changes. Go ahead, Dick.
That's an extremely good solution, Howie. Nowadays, when it comes to the 50-watt, 100-watt, 150-watt UPSs, boy, you can buy them for very few dollars. So if he ran a separate UPS just for his filament transformer, he would be guaranteeing exactly the right voltage all the time. And that's very few dollars. And that could be an extremely better reliability approach than anything we've discussed up till now. And if he's willing to dig into the design of the UPS, he could design the UPS to have the soft start characteristic where it slowly sneaks up on the voltage when he first turns on the unit code. I mean, a good modern UPS is a stepped square wave. And you could turn off part of the stepping function so that it starts off with a lower RMS voltage. It puts out a square wave with a little bit of a spike in the middle of it, so to speak. And you could turn off that spiking circuit during the warm-up procedure. Very good solution. What do you think of that, Rich? N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KQ2QIQ with a comment.
He could also get a better UPS for like $150. It'll give him a real sine wave, not a step.
QIQ recognize how Rich first, go ahead.
Okay, Dick, that's an interesting idea. Let me take it a step further. What about just running the filaments 24-7? Because that's what they do in commercial service. It might be better than banging them on and off. Those tubes are not cheap.
I don't recommend that. In the case of continuous commercial service, running them 24-7 where they want to have hot standby makes a lot of sense. But the total number of hours you're on the air per day, even though you're a retired person, is nowhere near, let me pick a number, 12 hours, with that transmitter running. If you're going beyond 12 hours per day, yeah, I think there's some merit in never turning off the filament. But if you're only using the transmitter 2 hours per day, and the other 22 hours is just sitting there, cooking its filament and wearing out. See, what's happening in the filament when it's hot, the cathode is hot, is you're continuously boiling up this valuable material between the bottom of the cathode material and the top. And that stuff is supposed to be boiling off at a controlled rate when the tube is being used with B-plus on it. I've heard stories about contaminating the cathode by having nothing but filament voltage turned on for you know, weeks on end without really using the tube for any emission. I think you can poison the cathode doing that. I'm not positive about that. KC2, it sounded like QIQ. Correct me and start off with your name, sir. My name is Dick.
I have a comment then, Dick.
Yes, Dick. KC2QIQ, my name is Glenn. It was just a small warning about UPS units, especially those cheap ones that have square wave outputs. Most of the ones that I've seen so far don't regulate the output voltage, unless they're in backup, meaning that the input AC has gone out of range, and then the battery is holding up the output waveform, and at that point it's regulated to the battery voltage. But if there are line swings that are within the range before it goes outside of the backup, generally you can still see very, very large swings of input AC.
Okay, so he's got a little bit careful to choose a good one. And maybe he doesn't want to buy the cheapest one. Considering the value he puts on those 8877s and the whole amplifier, if it was a choice of buying a $50 UPS or a really good one for $150, I'd go for the $150. Because the tubes themselves are worth quite a bit of dollars, and he doesn't really want to go through the process of replacing them in matched pairs. And by the way, stop worrying, Rich, about them being matched. When tubes are being used in parallel, and I've run into this situation ever since 1970 when I came out with the parallel kilowatt amplifier and triple-line circuit for 432, lots of people worried about what happens. Is the thing going to blow up if I put in a hot tube and a cold tube in the same pair, in the same amplifier? The answer is absolutely not. If the circuit is well designed, the voltage on each tube is forced, because they're in parallel, to be identical. If one tube is a lot healthier than the other and wants to draw more current, has more gain, let it do so. That's the combination that gives you the best performance of that amplifier with that particular set of tubes. Maybe a little bit of adjusting of the individual biases will help, but don't be troubled about the fact that one tube is drawing 60% of the current, the other tube is drawing 40%. That's not necessarily bad. Let's see, K2KEY. Go ahead, Bill.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Number one in my 30S1 linear amplifier, that tube is 3CX1500. It's been there since 1970 when it was built, it's still the original tube, and it's had a tremendous amount of life used on this life, so it, and it's still working excellent. I also do have that Variac. I have a tracking Variac, a line tracking Variac, the AC line, fairly constant. Sometimes during the summertime when those central air conditioners all down the block here are going on and off, you can hear the thing is hunting constantly, the Variac. But the tube life seems to be, with the way Collins does it, I can say with turning it on, you know, delay the filament by putting that resistor in and bringing it up somewhat slower, and the method that they're using that Collins developed back, I can say way back in the 70s for the 30S1 amplifier, is seems to be no problem because it's still running, Dick. There's a lot of years use on it. Doesn't show any signs so far of tube problem, over.
Excellent testimonial. So, since 1970, 37 years, you have on the same set of tubes in that Collins amplifier. And you're a guy that did not run the filament 24 hours a day. You do that soft start, and you turn on that filament and that amplifier when you need it. Give me a repeat on that one. And if so, that's an awful good testimonial for that one. Back to you, Mel.
Yeah, exactly. I know of a bunch of guys who get on at 75 meters, you know, the Collins collectors, and they're all running them. Oh, they got so much time on them. In fact, on my KWS-1, the guy had logs stacked about a foot high. He had thousands of contacts. He used to be on all night with that thing. I don't know if he got off the air at night, because I saw the amount of logs he passed away, and I foresee from his estate the Collins setup. And he had logs stacked up thick sheets. There must have been 40, 50 logs, ARRL logbook, handwritten in every call, you know, that he made and everything. He was on the air every night with that thing, maybe 4 or 5 hours, and the rig is still going strong, Dick, over.
Boy, they know how to treat that too. And you have reason to believe that tube is running 6.300 volts on that filament all of those years. Is that true?
5.00, yeah, 5 volts. Like I say, you got this adjustment on it, the filament adjust. I have touched it up a little bit every so often. You know, they got the multimeter on the panel where you can switch to read B-plus, filament, etc. Ticket. And then they got a separate meter for the plate, but they have the one for multimeter for reading the grid, KLC. Filament and everything like that. That's the separate meter. I flip it over to filament every so often and check it over.
Okay. I'm hearing a common denominator here, and that is we all think that, put the filament voltage on there, make it in the right ballpark, and the thing will play. I'm hearing the sound of there's a lot of merit of getting the filament voltage right in the center of the range that Collins or whoever manufactured that tube, Svetlana, recommended. That manufacturer and his engineers have gone through hell with exotic materials that are poisoning the living daylights out of the environment. If you lived within a mile of the Svetlana plant and you drank that water, you got to worry. All of those exotic chunks of chemistry that goes into designing a filament really is tough on the environment. When the company has put that much effort into making a filament that has the right emission for the right length of time, and all those exotic chemicals boil off at just the right rate and boil up to the surface at just the right rate, and they recommend a particular filament voltage, I'm hearing the sound that you better pay attention if you really want that tube to give you the right performance for what you think is the right length of time. I think it's worth the effort. It couldn't hurt. I think it was Barry and a few other people who want to make some further comments. Barry, do you have some further comments? K2, and to Mike Bravo, K2RIW.
Okay, real Dick, hope I got the right button here. I'm trying to work on the table at the same time, fixing some. Just one little thing. On that antenna thing we were talking about earlier, I want to space those two verticals What do we want to space them? A quarter of a wave? Is that what I want to do? Because they're not a quarter of a wave. 90 feet is more than a quarter of a wave.
90 feet is the apex distance. All of the radiation is not taking place from that little bit of couple of inches that are at the apex, Barry. I don't know the exact answer. I know that your electronic separation between those two antennas is greater than zero, that's where the tips are, and less than 90, that's where the apexes are. Somewhere in between there is your real electronic separation. And you have a radio tower in the middle, a wind jammer or whatever it's called, one of these water pumping towers from the Midwest. You've got a lot of other things hanging there. It's a complicated situation. You could put all of the crisscross bars and everything else of your tower into a modeling program and try to find out what the modeling program thinks is the electronic separation. It doesn't matter. You can measure it. And if you get it wrong, it's not going to explode. It's going to be an interesting experiment for you to add and subtract lengths of cable and measure front-to-back ratios. But quarter wave of electronic separation, I think, is a desirable location. It's not the only one. If you have a smaller spacing than that, I think you will not get quite the same front-to-back ratio. Let me think about this. No. With a slight sacrifice in gain, you can always adjust for the front-back ratio. The nice thing about quarter wave is that when you adjust for the best front-to-back on quarter wave, you're also getting the best forward gain. As you make the spacing very different from quarter, you'll always get what the right setting of that differential cable. You'll always get the cancellation in the back lobe. You just won't get the full benefit of the gain in the forward lobe. And I think we're talking about a half a dB difference, but you're fighting for that, and let's go for it. Back to you, Barry.
Okay, okay. But the desirable place to put the two verticals would have been a quarter of a wavelength. Is that what you're saying? It's not that it, I mean, that should be the spot that I would have wanted to look for if they were just pure verticals in free space.
You got it. If you were pure verticals in free space, you simultaneously have a solution where maximum front to back will also be maximum forward. As you deviate from quarter wave, you can always tune for best front to back, but you'll sacrifice a little bit of the forward gain at that setting. And a slightly different setting will give you best forward gain, but not as good a front-to-back, not as good a null. So quarter wave is the place where those two solutions come together. But we're speaking of quarter wave electronically, which because of this inverted V configuration, electronically is a little bit more difficult to predict. Hopefully in the original design of the guy who had this, he's already worked out those details. But you're a guy who's capable of making that measurement, Barry. Back to you.
Okay, okay, but do you think I'm making sense? Because, the mechanical separation is really quite a bit more than a quarter of a wave. 66 feet and some inches, I don't have the number in front of me, I did it before, it's probably on my calculator, would be, 61 feet, 6 inches. 61.6 feet would have been the mechanical quarter wavelength of spacing. But I don't have these at 61 feet, whatever. I have them at 90 feet. It seems like an awful lot. I'm just going by somebody else's idea, and do you think that maybe I should bring them a little closer in?
I would not bring them closer in until you make that measurement. Yes, the apexes are 90, and you think 60 is desirable, but the tips are zero, and you think quarter wave is desirable. I would not change that design until I made that measurement on your particular tower. You may be right in the sweet spot right now, and you don't know it, Barry.
Okay, okay. So we're going to stick with a mechanical 90 feet, and we'll start out with an electronic quarter wavelength and take it from there. Okay, very good. I want you guys to continue with the net. I am repairing this stupid light for the 10th time. I don't even know why I'm bothering anymore. I think after this, I'm going to give up on it.
I do that on some of my repairs. It's a matter of pride. I will put all kinds of integrated circuits into my television set when everyone says you should have thrown them away a long time ago. It's a matter of pride. Paul, WS2N, I think you had some further space stuff to tell us. Why don't you squeeze it in right now before we keep you up too late. WS2N, our space expert, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Well, no, I just had one little comment. it's been in the news lately, and now it's coming up to the point where Stephen Hawking, you know, he's the professor in ALS. That's what it is. He writes all these books, all about black holes. I mean, this guy is supposed to be the smartest guy going. You know, he's got Newton's job. You know, Newton was in charge of the science over there in that college over in Europe. Now they got Steve Hawkins doing it. They want to put this guy, and he wants to go onto what they call the Vomit Comet. You know, NASA uses a plane to duplicate zero G. So they're going to bring him, and I think it's the 26th of April, so that's coming up in a few days. They want to bring him to Florida. They're going to have a guy to take his place and see how they're going to handle this guy. You know, he's in a wheelchair and all, can't talk. They're going to take a mock-up Steve Hawkins and put him into the plane, see how they do going in and out. And they're going to have three or four doctors on board when he finally does do this. And if he makes it and says he's okay on the first parabolic flight, they're going to keep going and do a couple more to get this guy to float around in zero-G. So I thought that was a strange story. Kind of creepy, I don't know. This guy can't walk, he can't talk. But I guess it's something that he wanted to do. I'm sure that'll be in the news in about a week or so. And those 10 days went by quick. I didn't realize that that the last space tourist had landed already. I tell you, time is flying. It's like it was just on the news where he went up. So very good on whoever answered that, that he's back successfully. And yeah, they've never gone up in a space shuttle or returned in a space shuttle. Any of these four or five space tourists that have paid the $20 million and now $25 million to go. NASA really doesn't agree with it, but it's an international space station, and if the Russians want to blast the guy up there, they'll do it. So, back to you, Dick. Let's see, are we in the courtesy call mode here?
Not yet. We're still in that mode. So Stephen Hawking is going to take a Vomit Comet ride. My strongest recommendation is he do it on a thoroughly empty stomach. The reason I say that is because 50% of the astronauts, 50% of the cosmonauts, when they go into orbit, spend the first 24 hours upchucking, vomiting. Projectile vomiting in some cases. And you can't predict which one it's going to happen to. A guy could be on his third flight where the first two flights nothing happened, and the third one he gets sick as a dog, and vice versa. It's a fairly difficult problem. The human body has never previously experienced sustained weightlessness. We seem to be carefully designed for this particular planet, this particular environment, this particular level of gravity. And you suddenly take away that gravity in a sustained manner, and the vestibular system and the other portions of the body really goes kind of haywire for a while, regardless of the amount of practice. Practice helps to just solve it. When a person is in a weightless condition and gets sick and stuff starts coming out of your stomach and manages to get itself into your windpipe, a person who's got full muscle control can usually cough the stuff up and be back to normal operation. Take a man with Lou Gehrig's disease who has very little muscle control, and therefore he can't control that situation. I think it can get a little bit dicey kind of fast. So my strongest recommendation is that he not eat any food for 24 hours and maybe not drink any water for 8 hours or whatever before taking that flight, just to make sure there's absolutely nothing that can come out of his stomach. I still worry a little bit, though, because the stomach is still making all kinds of juices, and it may manage to find something to upchuck. Let's hope it doesn't happen. Although he's going to have physicians on board and maybe the right kind of equipment that can handle that situation. He's an awful gifted guy, and he wants to do that. He deserves to have that privilege. And if it costs some money, to take the KC-135 into the parabolic orbit so that he can sustain roughly a minute of weightlessness on repetitive occasions. If he wants it bad enough, I think he should have it. I would finance that. How about you, Paul? WS2M, K2LIW?
I'd like to go into space, but, you're going to start off on a vomit comet. If you can make it past that, I guess, you have maybe $25 million you can pay your way. Of course, the United States is not doing that, not accepting of any money yet. John Denver wanted to do that, I remember that, years ago, and NASA said no way. And then he was going to go to the Russians, but he changed his mind. He thought it was too much money. So, there you go. And this guy, he's really given us a lot to think about with black holes and all. And now I'm reading about white holes. Sorry about the white holes, Dick. You've got a black hole, where everything pops out. It could be coming out of a white hole. And this guy gave us Hawkins radiation and says that eventually a black hole could eventually decrease. I mean, he sits around thinking of this stuff day in and day out. So, and it's not like it's because he wound up with ALS. I mean, he was like that beforehand. So, he's quite a gifted there guy to come up with these theories.
Yeah, and a good percentage of them are correct, which is he's got a darn good batting average. So, a fun guy. I think he's at is it Cambridge or Oxford? He's got the what's it called now? Newton? Yeah, he's got the Newton chair. Is it at Cambridge?
Let's see. I've seen so many stories on it. Read so many. I don't know. Oxford, Cambridge. I don't know. Somebody else might know it. I forgot.
We'll eventually find out because there's got to be a UK aficionado out there somewhere who tell us. But he's obviously got an honored position, got a darn good track record, published a nice book, and what we're slowly discovering, space is stranger and stranger and stranger. We're discovering also that planets going around a star we used to think were one in a million, very, very rare, all of a sudden we find out the majority of them are that way. And by the same token, we're a solar system which has a single star in the center of it. And we think that's the best way to be, and we think that they all should be that way. It turns out that our particular star is a unary all by itself. There are more binary stars out there than there are unary stars. Mother Nature just likes making things that go around each other. So more of those stars are binary. And for a long time, people thought you can't make stable orbits of a solar system around a binary. Well, all of a sudden, they found one of those. I think somebody said you can't have stable orbits around a trinary. And I think they found one of those. So, whatever you think can't be done, Mother Nature's done it, no matter how rare it is. And I'm convinced we ain't alone. With all of that jazz going on, with all of that material being interacting for all of those billions of years, we've been humbled so many times. We thought we were in the center of the universe, everything revolved around us. Well, we're very far from that. We're just there. And guaranteed there's a whole lot of others. There has to be. This episode didn't happen just once. Unless you're a highly religious person that takes a particular interpretation, it's very difficult to justify that we're completely alone. Now, have we been visited? Have we been contacted? And that's a controversial subject. But are we truly alone? I strongly doubt it. We haven't been favored that much for us to be the only one. We haven't been favored that much for us to be the first. We haven't been at a disadvantage so much that we're the last. Guarantee we're in the middle. Of all the technological progress, of all the societies that are out there, we're somewhere near the middle. And that's a desirable place to be. That's an opinion. Okay, who have we skipped so far? And I guess we should find out what's really happening in Manhattan Beach. There's that's the center of RF activity in the borough of Brooklyn. K2KEY, K2RIW, bring us up to speed. And by the way, do look at the latest issue, you probably already have, of QSC Magazine. A fairly nice article about Smith chart, or at least the use of the Smith chart. Back to you, Mel.
This is K2KEY. Yeah, what a
the more they put it in print, the more questions I get, because it seems like, I don't know why, a lot of confusion. Dick have been inundated with the discussion of last week of decibels. And boy, oh boy, did I get emails with questions and all. First of all, there was a question that somebody sent me here, and he said, please let me know what the story is. Oh, by the way, you're very strong today on the input. Jake must be very excellent band musician. I have an antenna, he says. I have two antennas on the same band on HF. Do I have to worry about when one is connected? What do I connect to the other one that's in the shack? Can I just let it hang? Is there any danger? They are only separated by about 10 feet. What do I give them as an answer, Dick? Over.
Not to worry. I don't care if those two antennas are only 2 feet apart. When you put signal into the first antenna, a certain percentage of the signal on the same band, and even if it's not on the same band, it won't be as much, but still a certain amount of the signal is picked up by the second antenna. Well, the second antenna just happens to have a feed line that comes down into the shack. What happens if that so-called second antenna just happened to be 10 feet away, a Con Ed piece of wire that goes around the corner at the block, and therefore that little straight section just happens to be resonant on 80 meters? Is that a disadvantage? And the answer is, of course, not. What happens if a particular tree out there just happens to be the right altitude so it's resonant on 80 meters or 40 meters? Is that going to strongly disturb your particular antenna and stop it from working? Of course not. If you look at it from an area relationship, you suddenly realize that what you're worrying about is a very minor phenomenon. A full half-wave, 132-foot-long, 80-meter dipole made out of 14-gauge house copper wire, one of the most typical antennas on 80 meters that we often build. An egg insulator with the center, a coax cable or the twin lead going there, egg insulators with the two tips, ropes from the two tips going through whatever is high around your property, trees, towers, telephone poles if you're really brave, and whatever, to support the thing. When the sun shines at high noon on that antenna, the shadow of that wire shines onto the ground and gives you 1 square foot of shadow. You go through the formulas of gain, area of an antenna. Every antenna has to have a radio area to work. A full 80-meter half-wave dipole has an effective area, often called effective capture area, but that's a little bit confusing because it's got the exact same area on transmit. So it's got a real effective area of 8,500 square feet, and I'm not kidding. That's not a typo, if you know what I mean. 1 square foot of real wire shadow on the ground, but to a horizontally polarized signal striking that dipole, if your eyes operated at that frequency and you looked at that dipole, you would see an elliptical black hole around that dipole having 8,500 square feet of area. The elliptical hole would be a little bit to the left and a little bit to the right of the tip of the dipole, and would be about one-third of that width in the center of the ellipse. It's more narrow in the center, up and down, and it's wider left and right, and it's a little bit beyond the tips of the dipole, 8,500 square feet. The reason that's important is that if that Con Ed wire in front of you is at the exact same altitude, and it happens to be in the direction of your favorite buddy in London that you want to talk to, and you think you're going to be blocked in that direction, as long as that Con Ed wire is not resonant, it's only casting a couple of square feet of shadow onto your 8,500 square foot area antenna. It would be very difficult for you to measure the difference in signal strength of your buddy from London sending you a signal if you could suddenly make the Con Ed wire wink out and disappear. Your S-meter wouldn't move. If the Con Ed wire happens to be resonant, now life gets a little bit more complicated. If you're real lucky, it turns into a Yagi and gives you more directivity in that direction. If you're very unlucky, it gives you a null in that direction, but a peak in some other direction. So only if the Con Ed wire just happens to be resonant, very unlikely, is it really active. Now, with your two antennas on the same piece of property, 10 feet apart, yeah, some signal's going to be picked up by the second antenna. If you're enough of a scientist, you can put the right kind of a RF voltmeter in there and find out exactly how much, or you can put a dummy load on it. and put a very sensitive bird wattmeter and measure how much power. And so, of the signal that's picked up by the second unused antenna, you could measure how many dB down it is with a bird wattmeter or similar piece of instrumentation. And by putting a dummy load, you could terminate it, or you can decide not to terminate it. And now the signal coming down the cable will hit the open circuit, reflect back up, and be radiated in space. If you terminate it, by the laws of conservation of energy, you would be decreasing your signal somewhere a little bit. You're taking some of the power, it's being coupled to the second antenna, you're putting it into a dummy load, it turned into heat, and it's gone forever. And if you didn't do that, it's reflecting back up and making an extremely minor change in the pattern of your antenna. And for you to measure that would be difficult because it's a very minor perturbation. Not to worry, enjoy it, and if you want to be a scientist, go and measure how much signal comes in there. And I recommend you not terminate it. And if you don't, and if you put a short circuit on there, or an open circuit, and change the length of cable to that unused antenna, you are now shifting the phase angle of the re-radiation of that signal, and you can use that as a phased array to increase the signal strength in one direction and partially create a null in some other direction. That second antenna is a useful tool in your hand. It's another knob for you to turn. Have fun with it. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, says K2KEY. I hope to satisfy this young fellow that I was very upset about it, and I told him that I sure will bring it up so you can hear it right from the source. All right, next one was on DB. Oh, boy, did I get DB. I'm really DB'd out. I'll go over it one more time. Here's where the question was misunderstanding. Let's back up one. We'll repeat a little bit of last week. And then I'll answer the question again. Again, I'm going to re-stress this again. Constant impedance only. Put the word constant impedance. Make it in big letters and underline it for this case, because this is where the confusion started, I think. Again, let's take, for instance, the amplifier again in a 50-ohm system. We have a 50-ohm amplifier in a constant 50-ohm system. We're going to apply a signal of 1 microwatt at the input, or what we call minus 30 dBm. We're going to measure the output of the amplifier at 1 milliwatt, 0 dBm. And the question was, what is the gain? And if we apply the formula that we used, that 10 log of power out over power in, we see we have 10 log of 1 milliwatt divided by 1 microwatt, or 10 log of 1,000, which will be equal to 30 dB. Then the question is, well, am I looking at dB voltage or dB power? Well, if you use the formula 10 log of the power ratio or 20 log of the voltage ratio, it will come out to the same thing. It yields exactly the same result in a constant impedance system. I hope I said that right, Dick, because there seems to be a lot of confusion. Again, I'll say dB voltage or dB power. If we use 10 log of the power in our formula, use that one, or 20 log of the voltage, we use that other formula, the results will come out the same. I think that is clear as you can make it, Dick, over.
Absolutely. And now I'm going to add one little thing to it. In your example amplifier, you're putting in 1 microwatt, a millionth of a watt. You're getting out 1 milliwatt, a thousandth of a watt. That's a 1,000-to-1 ratio of input to output power. 10 log of that. Log of that is of 1,000 is 3, times 10 is 30. An amplifier has 30 decibels of real gain. If I now calculate the voltage of a microwatt going in and the voltage of a milliwatt coming out, a little bit difficult calculation, but if I did that, I would find the ratio of the voltages 31.6. So the voltage coming out is 31.6 times bigger than the voltage that went in. The power that came out is 1,000 times bigger than the power that went in. So let's go back to that voltage. 31.6 times more voltage came out. If I take the log of 31.6, I'm about to do it on a HP28S, I will discover, just as I thought, 1.5 on the nose. Multiply it by 20, and you get 30 dB again. dB are dB. Is that voltage dB or power dB? The answer is yes to both questions. Or the implied question. As long as the input impedance, the output impedance is the same. But now if you've got an amplifier with 25 ohms in and 50 ohms of output impedance, life gets a little bit more complicated. You run into an ambiguity. That ambiguity will cause engineers to argue with each other till midnight and beyond. It ain't a simple answer. It's a matter of making sure everybody's on the same page of the understanding of the problem. So for simplistic reasons, let's assume we've got input impedance and output impedance the same. And so when you do that calculation, you better come up with the same number of decibels of gain of that particular amplifier when it's used in the linear region. Just to give you one further example of this. And by the way, a microwatt is minus 30 dBm. A milliwatt is 0 dBm, dB with reference to a milliwatt. The difference between minus 30 and 0 is a 30 dB delta. It's got 30 dB of gain. The advantage of knowing it's got 30 dB of gain is I now can predict the next step. If instead of putting in a microwatt, I put in 10 microwatts, minus 20 dBm signal. As long as the amplifier is still linear, I will get out plus 10 dBm out. So I'm putting minus 20 dBm in, getting plus 10 dBm out. The delta between minus 20 and plus 10 is 30 dB. As long as that amplifier is still linear, it'll give me 30 dB of gain for all reasonable levels of signal I put in. That's one of the great advantages of these decibels. If the amplifier hasn't been shoved into nonlinearity by putting in too strong a signal or making the signal so weak that it gets buried in the noise somewhere, as long as I stay in the linear region, it should always give me 30.0 dB of gain, so to speak, no matter what signal level I put in. So calculations for different signal levels coming down your antenna and what's going to come out of the loudspeaker become a lot more easily handled if you become fluent in decibels. Not easy. The first few times you hear it, it's going to confuse you. That's normal. If you're frustrated, you're learning. Nell and I will go through it a couple of more times if need be. It'll make a little more sense. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Yeah, it was like I said, tried to answer them briefly on email. I had it was, I believe, 47 questions alone on DB. So, all right, another one was, again, this showed up a few times, that the use, again, now here I'll try to put in the right words, it may be you listen carefully, because maybe I'll put it in the wrong words, but I'm trying to phrase this correctly. The use of decibels to express the voltage gain of an amplifier in a system of non-constant impedances is a misapplication of decibels. Again, that's what I'm going to say. Use of decibels to express the voltage gain of an amplifier in a system of non-constant impedance is the most common misapplication, I should say. I'm going to put the word most common at misapplication of dB. And then why that leads into the next part of this question, Dick. Oh, this is a loodle. But did I say that correctly? Because, you know, I can twist words real quick, over.
I 97% agree with you, Mel. I'm going to reword it just a little bit. I'm going to agree with you that when the input impedance and the output impedance are not the same, which happens to be the general case, unfortunately, and you simplistically express decibels of gain, there's a lot of ways you can come up with a number that's kind of wrong. That doesn't mean that decibels cannot be used in situations of differing impedances. If you're smart enough, you can figure out what voltage and what impedance is going in that's got a certain amount of real power, and you can express that in dBm, real power. You can then calculate or measure what voltage comes out. You can measure what impedance there is at the output. You can convert that into power and express it in dBm. And now the difference between the input dBm and the output dBm are real gain in decibels of that amplifier. But notice that I said I calculated the voltage. I multiplied it voltage squared over resistance, if I use that particular formula, to calculate the real power being applied to the input and the real power coming out of the output, and converted those into power decibels. Now, where a person can easily go wrong is he conveniently, naively, forgets about the fact that the impedances are different. He measures the input voltage. He uses 20 log of that voltage compared to some reference. He takes the output voltage, takes 20 log of that, and he says the difference between those input dBs and the output dBs is dB of gain, and he has forgotten about the impedance differences. He'll come up with an answer that's wrong. However, if he carefully explained to his audience that I know the input impedance is 25, but I assumed it was 50, I know the output impedance is 50, I took the input voltage and the output voltage, and I used a 20 log formula with it, I came up with an apparent dB gain in voltage, that as long as everybody understands what you're talking about, it is a somewhat useful number. But if somebody then tries to revert that back to a power relationship, they'll come up with something that's wrong. So I won't say you can't use decibels within input impedances that are, in input and output impedances that are different. You've got to be a hell of a lot more careful, and you would better explain to people what you did when you came up with your numbers so that everybody's on the same page. It can be done, but there's a minefield there that you can easily fall in some traps of misunderstanding between the people involved. And if you're writing a specification that's going to a vendor of amplifiers, and you're paying big bucks for that amplifier, and that amplifier comes into the incoming inspection department, and they do a naive measurement and come up with a different number, and you start rejecting the amplifier, and it's really a misunderstanding of the technologies involved, and the people aren't really speaking the same language, their life can get complicated. Mel and I have been there. So be super careful, and the impedances aren't the same. K2KUI, K2LIW.
Exactly. I tried to basically give them an quick oversight, you know, that this is not the same way to go. That's different, sort of. Not the right way. It's more complicated than that. This read into the next part of the question about noise power and dB. And I tried again to answer that noise power and dBs, I see what he was getting at in the receiver, and I think I can give you the example in about a couple of minutes. But I think the best way to, we did discuss once in the receivers about noise power, noise situation, noise analysis of in a receiver. And I think the best way to say again that the noise power available in a system, let me see if I can get this worded right. The noise power available in a system is a function directly of the noise system bandwidth. Okay, let me put it again. That the noise power available in a particular system is directly a function of the system noise bandwidth. Now, I'll read that, then we'll get into where I went from there. First of all, is that a correct statement, Dick Over?
Very, very close. Noise bandwidth, I think, if you want to be one step closer to the bureau, you'll call it noise equivalent bandwidth. I can have a Chebyshev filter that looks like a brick wall with very minor ripples to it, and I can measure its 3 dB bandwidth. I can then go and measure its noise equivalent bandwidth, and I will come up with a slightly different number. If I have a purely Gaussian filter, Gaussian-shaped filter, and I measure the 3 dB bandwidth, the noise equivalent bandwidth most likely is the identical number. So with more exotic filters is something slightly different when bandwidth, noise equivalent bandwidth versus what you and I would call noise bandwidth, or just plain bandwidth. But where this comes about is I'm looking at the spectrum analyzer screen, and I'm looking at a signal, and the signal is a nice clean sine wave, and it gives me a spike in the middle of the screen of a certain amplitude on the screen, and I measure its power, and if my spectrum analyzer is well calibrated, I know the power of that signal. That's the good news. Alongside of that signal coming out of this noisy amplifier is some noise. It's a bunch of grass near the bottom of the screen to the left and to the right of my signal. And now somebody says, gee, that noise is sitting at minus 80 dBm on the screen. Is that the noise power? Absolutely not. In the case of that signal, I could measure it with a well-calibrated, well-adjusted spectrum analyzer. I could measure it with a 1KC bandwidth filter, the 30KC bandwidth filter, the 100KC bandwidth filter, the 1 megacycle bandwidth filter, and if that analyzer is properly calibrated, I will come up with the exact same number of the power of that signal, regardless of what filter I use. That's what happens with a good signal. But now when I measure that noise power, as I make the filter more and more wide, the apparent power of the noise goes up on that screen. So therefore, if you're describing noise power, you cannot say the noise power is X dBm or X number of microvolts. You can say it is minus 80 dBm when measured with a 1 megacycle filter. And by the way, that's a magic number. All good spectrum analyzers in the most sensitive range before you turn on the preamplifier, all good spectrum analyzers manufactured since roughly 1967. To this day, most good spectrum analyzers in the 1 megacycle filter, the basic noise on the screen, will be at an apparent power of minus 80 dBm. I say apparent power because, to be more exact, it is minus 80 dBm per megacycle. So whenever you're measuring noise power, if somebody didn't tell you the bandwidth with which he measured it, he only gave you one-third of the information. He's given you ambiguous information. So noise can only be defined within a bandwidth of measurement. As you make the bandwidth of measurement wider, you accept more and more of the noise, the apparent power goes up. The power didn't really go up on the basic signal source. You've got an amplifier that's making noise. If I use a 1KC filter, I'll measure a noise power of minus 110 dBm. I use a 1 megacycle filter, I'll measure a noise power of minus 80 dB. Minus 110 dBm per kilohertz, minus 80 dBm per megacycle, is the exact same amount of noise power density. The word density means I measured it in a known bandwidth. So noise power must be measured in a defined bandwidth if you want to make the measurement traceable to the bureau. K2KUY,
K2RIW in the tech net. Hey, this is K2KUY. All right, sort of boils it down to a little bit maybe easier for them to understand at the time. I know this is very hard for people to understand. I know I struggled with it too. I'll admit to it. The formula, there is a formula for measuring noise bandwidth and all, which is that formula that I think we once again discussed when we were going through receivers. That's the formula that PN is equal to K times PO times the bandwidth and watts, and using K as pulse and constant and everything, and the final answer it comes out, we worked it out, is joules or degrees Kelvin and so on and so forth. That's the formula. I'm not going to get into any details now on that, but I see where they crept in the misunderstandings here, because now suppose we had two different noise bandwidths and we want to know which one's noisier. I think I knew what they were getting at, and this is basically the answer I gave briefly. I said if we were to consider an amplifier and say with a power gain, we'll use the letter G, the gain, and it had, for instance, a variable bandpass filter and a meter, put a a good power meter tied to the amplifier output. And with the bandpass filter, let's say we set it for narrow,